afternoon. Welcome, Patrick. Another brisk and chilly afternoon in Melbourne.
It is. It's the 24th of June, and I'm in Melbourne talking to Father Peter Collins from the Blessed Sacrament Order in St. Francis Church in Lonsdale Street in Melbourne. Peter, you've been in the Order how many years now?
Oh, golly. 35.
35
years.
And your position here in the Order in Melbourne is the...
I'm the community leader here at St. Francis.
Right.
And I also have a second portfolio, if you like to call it, as being the Assistant Provincial for Australia, for the Order.
So your work takes you in and out of Australia a fair bit. You actually do...
Yeah, part of our outreach is in India and Sri Lanka. They're part of the Australian Foundation missions. So I have work over there at different times. And for the last 9 years, I've been also doing some work in Vietnam with our communities.
Right. And the communities there, what is the basic work that they're involved in? Is there anything in particular that those communities do that on a worldwide basis in terms of their connection to the local communities? What exactly is the nature of your work?
Probably what's characteristic most of all in India and Sri Lanka is that our communities and centres of community life and worship are really on the cutting edge of life with the poor. Lots of homeless people, marginalised people in those, in some of the great cities of India, Mumbai, Chennai, various other smaller areas that branch out from there. So the communities are living fairly simple sort of lifestyles themselves, our men there, and they're working really close in harmony with people who are struggling just to make ends meet on a day-to-day basis. Very different to what we have in Australia, where we're living in a very settled environment, safe and secure. I suppose we're in the first world. We don't want a great deal. We don't lack for many things at all. Over there, it's a very different feel. It's just a whole different environment into which you live and move and work. And
how does that affect
exercise?
You as you move between the two? Because you do that a fair bit, don't you?
Yeah.
You suddenly find yourself in Melbourne for a 6-week period, and suddenly you can be in
the back streets of Bombay or Chennai.
So you must be constantly confronted with this vast gulf, not only between what is in actuality the wealth situation, but in the very nature of what people's hopes and expectations can possibly be for their whole lives. How do you compare the people that you work with here in Melbourne to the people that you work with in India or Vietnam in terms of what they hope for themselves?
I think, well, all people have certain hopes and dreams and expectations, but they're always pitted against the culture in which they live, where they find themselves environmentally. And in some instances, in India, Sri Lanka, Vietnam or the Philippines, the awareness that people might have of things on a broader scale is perhaps not as highly developed. And so their expectations for their own life and well-being may not be as reinforced as we would have them in the first world, where we're exposed so much to many cultural impacts upon our life, the whole world of advertising, freedom of movement, music and fashions, all those sorts of things. They readily create deeper appetites for us here. In those other countries, I find people are living at a probably more simple subsistence level of life, and they look in many instances just from one day to the next for basic things for living. And yet there's a certain freedom that I enjoy over there that they don't have, and I don't seem to have any great expectations of wanting some of the luxuries or the things that we take for granted here when I'm over in those countries. I can adjust myself fairly readily to a very simple sort of lifestyle, and whether it be in the forms of travel with the people, in the forms of the food that we eat over there, you can manage quite adequately without all the high technology of laptop computers and stereo systems and everything else. You find a new way of living among and with these people, and for the most part, I guess I find that I learn a great deal more. I don't go there with answers. I don't go there with the solutions to their big problems. I go there to listen and to try to understand the hungers of the human heart in the lives of my confreres, members of the community there, and through them with the people with whom they're associated. You know, many of these people are just either wanting employment or they're wanting enough rupees that they can earn a day to buy food for their family or to keep some sort of shelter upon them, you know, when the monsoons break.
So, but they are aware, though, that you're, if you like, a visitor from a more affluent world. It must seem almost like a completely different planet to them. How aware are they of the affluent living standards that exist in a place like Australia, the place that you've come from? And how does that change in any way the way that they relate to you while in the time that you're there?
Well, I think they certainly are aware of the fact we travel from one country to the other. We internationally in our congregation, there are people on the move all the time in and out of various countries and continents of the world. And so people in those home cultures see us come and they see us go. So they're obviously aware of the fact that there is sufficient financial backing to enable us to do the travelling that we have to do, albeit at their service and well-being. I don't think they're necessarily aware of all the social issues that we face in a country such as Australia. They may not be as necessarily well informed in some of the villages in India or Sri Lanka and Vietnam of the political innuendos that we face here or some of the constantly emerging social issues. Many people over there get quite surprised when we talk about the conflict of interest at times or the difficulty in race relationships in this country or the whole issue of drug abuse on the part of young people. They just find that in a country such as Australia that they would never anticipate that some of those things would exist. Mm. The whole recent events of asylum seekers that's high on the horizon here for a lot of people has not necessarily impinged itself upon their minds.
But they must be aware that quite a fair number of Vietnamese people, for example, have resettled in Australia.
How do they view those expatriates?
What's their response to the idea of going to live in a place like Australia or America?
I don't think I've broached the topic in precisely those words with people saying in Vietnam, but many people over there whom I've met say they have relatives in the United States or in Australia, and now that things have eased up a little bit with regards to the government in Vietnam, some of these relatives are now able to make return visits home, and they get a very different picture then of what life is like in Australia. And many of them who go home and now who have the freedom of access because they're Australian citizens and they have their own passport and can travel freely, many of them hold the hope of being able to get their families to come, say, to settle in Australia at some time. Whether or not that will be possible is another issue altogether. I mean, financially, it's a huge cost. And then there's the whole issue of obtaining visas. But people, through travel and through the modern means of communication now, are able to tell stories, and the stories, albeit come from a particular perspective of the person who tells the story, and that creates an image, and that image is added to another image, and that's linked with another story, and over a period of time you have a whole bigger picture that emerges, and those who hear the stories can then find certain yearnings within their heart to be able to move beyond what they're experiencing at the present time. But for the most part, I think probably I find that the energy on the part of the young people in India and Sri Lanka, Vietnam, those who are able to pursue educational pursuits and advance their education are the ones who are perhaps far more aware of issues beyond their own country now.
Right.
their parents or their grandparents perhaps know the story only too well of what they've gone through back in their home country and the legacy that they now inherit as a result of cultural impact and war and violence, deprivation. But the young now have links with so many other parts of the world through the internet and email services, telephones, and through education. And they're the ones who potentially have the great opportunities to travel. And I think that will change their whole perspective on life. And equally, when they come back to their home country, they're potentially the agents of change in their social environment.
All right, we seem to be moving, and a lot of the things we've talked about on this program have often impinged on the way that globalisation is actually changing the world. In other words, I suppose to some degree that whereas we all used to live within our national borders, for good or for ill, we're starting to live within a global situation. Now, you're one of the rare religious orders that actually work right across the world in lots of different areas.
We work in 35 countries.
35 countries. Well, how do you see your order as being agents of easing the world into that new, more globalised reality? Do you ever think about it in terms of that? And the fact that you, if you like, are bridge builders to some degree between cultures, how do you see the world of, say, 50 years from now being different as a result of your order's work in those countries and the way they link people?
I'd like to think there'll be evident signs of the work that we do. We're only one small part of, I think, of a much bigger picture, the reality of the massive movement, the fluidity of the human population at the moment. You know, we overlap borders very, very easily, and that's evident with the migratory patterns of so many people, even at this present time. I think that our own religious congregation worldwide, coupled with so many other international communities, see that we can only make very small steps. I think we're endeavouring to be the bridge builders into a new future, and we don't know what that future is going to be. We would, I guess, hope that somehow in the midst of the gigantic changes that are taking place within the whole of our world environment at various levels, that at the deeper level of the search for meaning and the spiritual quest in the lives of people, that somehow we're able to respond to that in practical ways that give people a sense of connectedness. And in a community such as ours that sees its life centred in the gathering in Eucharist, where it's seeking to be faithful to the Lord in the breaking of bread and the sharing of the cup of fellowship, that by engaging in the Eucharistic ritual and prayer and celebration of worship, that somehow this has a direct implication for trying to respond to the deeper levels of the hungers of people, you know, for justice and for reconciliation, for their ultimate freedom, to be able to live their life free from the worries of potential violence and destruction of their culture, of their own personal life, their well-being as citizens of the world. And I think that the simple thing of gathering in Eucharist has enormous implications for the way we live our life and the way we connect with other people. And so part, I think, and would hope, is that of our legacy through our mission and through our engagement in the specific fields that we are trained in and which we can offer some response, I think it's to help connect with people and give them and help them to discover a lifeline towards a new future. Now, how and in what way that's going to be shaped and realised, I don't know. I really don't know, because at the present time, there are increasing numbers of people who have great dissatisfaction with the church as an institution and bear a lot of grief and anxiety within their hearts through personal or wider experience. Other people at the same time turn to the community of the church and religious communities such as ours in the hope of having some connection, that maybe there are values, maybe that there is a lifestyle that we carry through tradition and seek to embody, albeit in a new and creative way in the church and in the world today, that people see that maybe through connection with a community such as ours, there is potentially the opportunity to continue a sense of their own well-being and their livelihood for the future. And whilst they may not want to necessarily commit themselves wholeheartedly to all the facets of the institutional life of the church, their connection with individual people through a community and some of its life force and energy gives them a connection with the church community at large, I think.
Well, you've spent how many years now in the Orlin?
35 years this year, and 26 of those as a priest.
And you still remain hopeful about the future and the relevance of the church in the various communities in which it works. You don't feel that some of those questions you raised about the way youth might feel that the church is relevant in the world anymore, they don't disturb you in terms of worrying about the future of the order and the church more generally?
I think, well, it depends if you want to look at the church as an institution. The church's institution will eventually have its day. Mm-hmm. As a dynamic community of interactiveness of people, the church lives at various levels and functions at various levels on a daily basis.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think people associate vibrant living communities.
Mm-hmm.
And individuals within that, and if they make their connection at that point and say, well, the local church for me, this group of people with whom I can associate, with whom I can pray or be welcomed and share the Eucharist, if that's their understanding experience of church, far healthier than looking upon it as some vast international organisation, a monolith that you can't embrace.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a local community of people can be far more embracing, and they can speak the words that touch the human heart. Whereas oftentimes people tend to equate the church with the various buildings that we have built up.
But the church is having a harder time actually sustaining those small, vibrant communities, or it seems that way to me, that a lot of the country communities, for example, that I visit in the course of my work, they're shrinking, they don't have priests, the number of priests is not as large as it was. Some of those small churches have been virtually closed altogether. How do you see the church is going to regroup in the face of that into the coming century?
Well, I think some aspects of the institution just have to die off, and the bureaucracy have to pass through a whole purgation experience. One of the great sadnesses is that in the smaller communities, rural areas of our country, and vast areas of Southeast Asia, there are strong, vibrant communities of people who have no priest. But they sustain their faith as lay Catholic people, lay Christians, in a very strong and vibrant way. The difficulty for many of them is that because of the tradition of the church through its laws, that you have to have a male celibate person to be the presider of the Eucharist, for example, many of these basic communities are being deprived now of the very source of their spiritual life in the Eucharist.
But has some of their importance as lay people or as lay participants been elevated because of the fact that there is no priest around it, to some degree, as the dynamics in those communities changed? Are they a more vibrant church because they're self-organising?
Possibly in some of the areas, say in the Philippines, for example, they would be very vibrant. I mean, in some of the rural areas there, they might have a priest come once every 2 or 3 months. But those communities are strong, vibrant, they attend to the education of faith, the celebration of other special moments in their lives, and they do that very faithfully. And I think these basic Christian communities are, in a sense, the emergence of a new church.
A new church? You mean a new model, a new paradigm for the church?
A whole new model that will eventually, I think, spill over even into the First World. And given the sort of circumstances that we find at the moment, I think that probably within the next 30 years, we'll find that the centre of Catholicism will be in Southeast Asia and Africa. It will move geographically from a European-based...
Do you mean in numbers or in intensity of devotion of its adherents?
Well, both. I think certainly in the numbers. There is a strong, vibrant, emerging church face in the countries of Southeast Asia and Africa now that probably in 20 to 30 years' time will make the geographical centre of our world for Catholicism based in Africa or in Southeast Asia.
But Peter, this almost seems to fly in the face of what we're actually seeing. What you're talking about is a more democratised church brought about by the fact that there's not, if you like, enough priests to go around, a church more run by its grassroots. And yet hasn't the entire thrust of the recent papacies been towards a situation of more centralised power in Rome? How are these two conflicting dynamics going to resolve themselves?
Well, I'm not too sure what the resolution will be, but the fact is they both coexist at the present time, and it creates a lot of tension. I don't think that we can ever go back to having everything centralised again. And all the quests that go on at the present time of trying to reel things back into one central hub at the Vatican will serve its purpose for a period of time, but then ultimately I think we'll have to recognise that that can't be sustained. The hankering after a church of the past, the models of the past, based on male dominance and clericalism, is just not the story of the Catholic world today.
Because it's not sustainable? Is that what you're saying?
It's unsustainable in
that
sense.
They don't have the personnel to have such a model.
And equally, you know, the requirements of candidates for the priesthood today, which we've inherited over 1,000 years of a male clergy, a celibate clergy. You look back into the scriptures and the New Testament times of the church, where all the things that we now have in place, the various strata of officialdom and the clericalisation of the church, didn't exist for the first century and a half. You had ministries which were created and evolved depending upon the needs of the community. And some of those ministries were held by women who were called to the public leadership of the community.
That's part of church history.
You can look back into the scriptures, the New Testament, you'll find that, you know, there were women who held positions of leadership of local communities. And then throughout some of the earlier eras of Christianity, the same was true. But then gradually you have this more centralisation and the building up of the bureaucracy of the institution of the Catholic Church. And with it came the whole establishment of a hierarchy. And with that, there is all the issues associated with power and with control. And I think a lot of the things that are creating so much havoc at the present time can be traced back to the same issues for today, power and control over people's lives.
Well, putting it within the context of your particular order, Peter, you started out 35 years ago in this order. If what we're talking about is a shrinking personnel base for centralised, male-dominated hierarchies to exist, tell me about the experience of this order. What has happened to the numbers in this order and to the age of this order over the last 35 years that you've been involved?
I think I joined the community here in Australia in the years after the Second Vatican Council, which was 1962 to 65.
Those heady, halcyon days when we all believed the world was about to change.
Correct. And there were high expectations of what potentially could take place. And I think they were days of great energy and vitality. When I joined our Australian province in 1967, was a time when we were just beginning to hear the call for a complete review and a rediscovery of the essential elements of religious life and of the basic purpose of our religious community. And it was the beginning of a major review that was to go on until 1984, in our instance, whereby throughout the whole world from 1969 to 84, we went through a whole series of phases of a complete review of our life, of attempts to revisit and rewrite the basic rule of life, moving from a fairly legalistic approach, which was called the constitutions, that were attributed to our founder and his early associates that we had inherited, moving to a rediscovery of perhaps what the vision of the founder might have been, that was not incorporated into legislation, but something that's far more enriching, far more challenging.
So the order moved.
We, albeit painstakingly and with a lot of times dissension, and in those years from the mid-60s to the 70s, it was a time of fragmentation where people felt very threatened that their set patterns of lifestyle were now being perhaps put under the spotlight for review, that our engagement with the people at large, we lived a semi-monastic lifestyle. And in those days, our forms of contact with the people, in many instances, were very, very much conditioned and determined according to the local house where we lived or the engagement of ministry that we had. The way we lived our life in the community, from the clothes that we wore to the way we interacted with one another, periods of silence, meals taken in silence, all those sorts of things had value, but then over a period of time they just became ritualised in life.
Yeah.
And through the renewal movement we were called to rediscover the basics of table fellowship, for example, what it means to come together as a community of brothers and partake of